On the halacha on Rav Moshe. Do me a favor, Menachem Mendel, just check that the tape is turning. Today is Sunday, February 24th, 2008. And we have a very fascinating material today. Unbelievably fascinating. And some of it is I don't know whether anyone's ever touched upon these points. But where were we last week? We finished that last week, Yudin Rat. And I think I showed, it's not that I insist that I'm right and Dr. Farbstein is wrong, but I think, you know, when the truth is with you, you have to stand on it. And I think from Yudin Rat we saw clearly that this issue comes up already in 41, and everyone knew that we're dealing here with life or death. What's fascinating about Yudin Rat is that there's endless material how in every ghetto this debate took place. Do we follow the Rambam? Don't we follow the Rambam? And at times, when they followed the Rambam, the end result was that more were taken and killed than were originally asked for. So that this was a real debate, halacha lemaisa, and it went on in every ghetto, and the Kovner Rav fainted because he understood that what they were asking him. So I stand on Ratzolat Klal Yisrael, and then I moved sideways, and I said, right now, in the headlines in Israel, we have this very problem. And here you have the question today of the price for Gilad Shalit, what to pay. And we went into, I showed you the sugya and gittin, I showed you the halacha, showed you some of the achronim, on the whole question of ein podin et hashvuyim yoter al demeichem. And what's the reason? Is it's that we shouldn't become poorer, they shouldn't kidnap more. And there's no question that once you're willing to give 500 prisoners for one soldier, labriyot, so you've raised the price and you've whetted their appetite. It's, very simple. It's lahavdil on a more humorous situation. You have Talmud Chacham in the, the Lakewood world, and his parents announce this boy is available to the girl who will come in with the best offer. And I don't have to tell you, we've had stories from time immemorial where he already was going to get engaged, but someone came in with a better offer, and it ain't l'davasof. The minute you make clear you're willing to accept the best offer, so of course it whets their appetite, and lahavdil between my example and between the reality of a captured soldier, lo aleinu, they want 500. Even today in the news, the first item in the news, if you read the papers today, is, I saw it on Friday, that someone who's very close to the negotiation said the price is just impossible to pay. And I raised a second issue that it's not just the price that you pay, but Latzalat Klal Yisrael, that at times you have to sacrifice one person to save so many others. Because once you let out 500 murderers, the statistics do not lie. And all of us are sophisticated enough to know we live in a world of statistics. This has to do with all aspects of life today, whether it's medicine, whether it's economics. We live in a world of statistics. And statistics do not lie. And if you let out 500, statistics show at least 40 will go back and be murderers and killers. And Latzalat Klal Yisrael, you're going to save one life and you're going to give up 40, 50, 60 other lives. And this too enters into the equation, and it takes us back to the words of the Noda B'Yehuda. Now, I want to go further, and I want to say something that none of you thought of, and this certainly enters very prominently into the entire issue. Yes, Moshe. Yeah, Harod Shah.
So, like,
right. That's what I want to mention right now. What I'm going to bring up right now, you could put under that rubric if you wish. But what you're going to see that there's another factor here which none of you have called attention to. The newspapers do bring it out of the closet. And this is another factor. There's another factor here. When you talk about Hatzalat Klal Yisrael, you're running an army, the Israeli Defense Forces. No army in the world has been so challenged in the last half century or even longer, 60 years now that we have a state, and even before the state, Palmach and Haganah and Eitzel and Lehi, no army has been so challenged. Natan, I mean, yeah, this is an army, and as it's said about Israel, we cannot afford to lose a war. We cannot afford to lose a war. It's not like America that lost the war in Vietnam, that may very well lose the war in Iraq. Right? It doesn't affect the mainstream of American life. Even in the present election, you all know that economics has taken over the Iraq issue. Israel cannot afford to lose a war. And the Israeli army developed a certain spirit, which is characterized by one famous expression, epigram: we do not leave a soldier on the battlefield. We do not leave a soldier on the battlefield. And the army has fought with this moral. Everyone inducted into the army knows you're becoming part of Tzva Haganah Yisrael, and Tzva Haganah Yisrael praises itself that it does not leave a soldier on the battlefield. Now, you just think, what are the implications if we say, let Gilad Shalit rot, we are not going to redeem him, we are not going to pay the price. In simple terminology, we are leaving a soldier on the battlefield, with all the implications. Now, how do I know this is an issue? And let me move sideways and very briefly go into a topic that I covered in great detail many, many years ago. There's a Gemara. It appears twice in Shas. Once it appears in... Once it appears in Masechet Ketuvot, Daf Tet Amid Bet, and it's a very famous Gemara. Kol hayotzei l'mulchamet beit David, yet kritut kotev le'ishto. That same Gemara appears in Shabbat, Daf Nun Vav Amud Aleph. That's where everyone knows it from. Because to go on Shabbat, kol haomer David chata eino ela toa. That if you say David sinned with Bathsheba, you're making a mistake. And that's a famous Gemara because today, with part of the thrust of I would say, Chovevei Torah and the study of Tanakh, and the whole question, do you view our great forefathers, heroes of Tanakh, do you view them in human terminology, or are they demigods, let's say? No, I'm not joining any crowd. This is the issue. And it's been debated, it's been written about, and one of the Gemaras that they pull out and say that this Gemara shows what Rabbi Rubin calls an artscroll mentality, Kol Omer David Chatein Olatot. So it's a famous Gemara, but the sugya is not in Shabbos. The sugya is really in Ketuvot. And of course, well, according to Saint Mochanet by David, Kol Tev Get Kritzot Le'ishto. What is so important about this Gemara? Because when a person goes to war, your greatest amount, the Reuven, don't sit so far, come close. When a person goes to war, your greatest amount of fear is the Aguna issue. And this, already Chazal understood how difficult this issue is. So in order to ameliorate the problem, Chazal tell us a tradition that Chayalei Beit David, before they went to war, would write Gittin for their wives. Now, right away, I don't want to go into the sugya now, it's not germane, but right away you have to ask a question: who here is a Kohen? If you write a get for your wife, how can you remarry? So I like the Rishonim deal with it, Tosfos deals with it. It could be that for a Kohen you write a get al Tanai, but one thing is for sure, that Chazal understood the terrible fear of women remaining agunot, and therefore they required every soldier to write a get for his wife. Now, this halacha remained dormant for 2,000 years, for basically one simple reason. We have not seen chayalim in the Jewish world since the Bar Kokhba era. I don't think afterwards we have ever come across an organized Jewish army. In modern times, of course, when we come out of the ghetto, and again, those of you that heard my lectures on Napoleon Sanhedrin on my Monday class, understand me very well, that when we came out of the ghetto, Napoleon, who certainly was not an anti-Semite, might have very well been a philo-Semite, Napoleon said to the Jews, put up or shut up. If you're coming out of the ghetto and you want the rights of citizenship, and you follow me, Michael, and you want to be a citizen of France, and you want the benefits of France, are you willing to pay the price to be integrated? And part of that price is serving in the army. So beginning with Napoleon, and as we move in even to Polish Jewish history, Russian Jewish history, German Jewish history, suddenly we see Jews in the various armies. Now, the Jews who were from went about writing Gittin or leaving authorizations for Gittin, but this practice continued through World War I and through World War II. With the IDF, for the first time, you have a massive Jewish army. As we said last week, the IDF is a citizen's army. Everyone in the state of Israel should be a member of the army. It may even be Al-Pi Halacha. Rabbi Lichtenstein wrote an article in Tradition a number of decades ago where he shows clearly that every able-bodied Jewish youth in the world is obligated to serve in the IDF. Now, when you have an IDF, what are you going to do? Everyone is married. 50% of the army is married. 70% of the army is married. When you call up a time of war, when the Miluim are called up, 80% of the army is married. I mean, my grandson is in the army now. He just got married, and he's in regular army, not in Miluim. And quite a few are married in his unit. But when you talk in terms of Miluim and a citizen army and warfare, so what do you do? Now, this was a real problem, and if you go back to the 1940s, into the early 50s, they attempted to introduce Chayalei Beit David, Kotvim Gittin L'Nesheihem, and Pshuto K'mashma'o, to have soldiers, when they leave their house, authorize the giving of a get for their wives. I don't go into, as I said, if I get a Rabban d'Lamdas now, it'll take me far abreast, but I'm speaking on a popular level. You can hear my shiurim from years and years ago on a much deeper level, and they introduced this. My dear students, it did not work. It did not work because it was found to demoralize the entire army. It's a citizen army. The front lines are around the corner. Remember what I told you last week? If Shas has its way, the border will be within an easy walk of where we're sitting now. Menachem Mendel has walked it many times. I'm an eyewitness because I pass him in my car and I see him walking back from the Kotel. So do you understand what I'm saying? There's so many problems. A soldier is in the army. A soldier comes home. He's with his wife. The minute he's with his wife, you mavatl the intention to give a get. You then have to sign again. You have to do the form all over. So you're demoralizing. Every soldier going out to war, the last thing he does is he thinks, I'm going to be killed. I'm going to drop dead. I'm going to be lost. I'm going to be pulverized in a tank. Nothing will remain of me. And that's the last thing he does is he once again writes the authorization to give his wife a get. It was found demoralizing. And the army had to stop the practice. What the IDF did, it moved in a different area to take precaution to avoid the problem of Aguna. And there, the Israeli army has achieved the level of 99.99% perfection. With Ron Arad, I'll tell you in one second, but I can't go into detail now. Everything I mentioned, I dealt in great halachic detail many years ago. Ron Arad is slightly the one exception. I say slightly because the truth is he was declared dead. And we don't want to declare him dead publicly for political reasons, but the Beitin permitted his wife to remarry years ago. But Ron Arad publicly is the one exception, more or less. Now, what did the army do? It's very simple. The day you the day you're mitchayal, that's the new Hebrew word, the day you become a soldier, so right after they give you a misparishi and then all that goes with it, an identity number, they do a tooth chart on you. They take fingerprints. Now, all of you understand that teeth, those of you that have studied biology, those of you who have studied medicine, teeth and hair survives for hundreds and hundreds of years, if not in a good climate. They found from Matsada, where it's a warm climate, they found teeth and hair from 2,000 years ago. No two people's teeth are alike. Believe me, my teeth are so different, and it changed last week. I had oral surgery on the bottom of my mouth, so my teeth are now totally different. And that was Berchatav. I had an appointment to see the oral surgeon, who happens to be my student. God should protect him. He's fabulous, Billy Levine. My son-in-law sent me to him, so I was only supposed to confer with him. I had a date for the operation at the end of March. But it snowed on Tuesday, so Billy says, Rebbe, when will you be home again? I said, I'll be home by 11 o'clock. Call me when you get in. Maybe there'll be a cancellation. So my Tuesday ended very differently than it began. Now, everyone's teeth are different. You have fillings. You have a different tooth structure. So that's what they do next. Fingerprints. Fingerprints are 99.99% reliable. Today, they work beyond fingerprints. Today, they take a DNA sample. DNA is, I would say, practically 100% reliable. So the Army has worked very diligently to resolve the problem. And Baruch Hashem, it has been resolved. God forbid if a body is not recovered. So then there are other ways of being Mater and Aguna with Trei Sveika, with Trei Lube. And this requires Lamdonim and a Beitin, and the army has one area of the rabbinate where the Rabbanim specialize in this ability. Rav Ovadia Yosef, after the Yom Kippur War, led the Batei Dinim. There were Mater hundreds and hundreds of Agunat, and he set the pace. It's not that he was Mechadesh. This all goes back to Rabbi Zohan Spector. You can read about it. My good friend Aaron Rakefet published on Rabbi Zohan's 100th Yahrzeit. He published a piece in Tradition, which now appears on the Rakofet Aaron Chelik Bet, where Rakefet explains Rabbi Zohan in detail, because Rabbi Dr. Ephraim Shimoff, who did his doctrine of Rabbi Zohan, left out the Agunah aspect because he said it would be too difficult to write about in English. People would not understand it. So, and Rabbi Belkin, in his introduction, compliments Rabbi Shimoff, Zichronim Tzadikim Levrach, they were wonderful people, compliments Rabbi Shimoff that he was wise to leave that aspect out. So I say, Mokom Hinichulu Abatov Lipgadebo, it left a little guy like Rakefet a chance to do something big. And I'm very proud of that article on Rabbi Zichronim, where I explain in detail. And he was the one who set the pace for Heter Aguna in modern times, which Rav Ovadia led the Beis Din, and Baruch Hashem, the Israeli army has done wonders, and it doesn't break down the morale. Now, what does it show you? The morale of an army is very important. I would even say it's Latzalat Klal Yisrael. You cannot have an army fight and win if the morale is not high. This not only affects Aguna, it affects many aspects of the halacha. I'll give you two examples, halacha lemaisa. No, I don't know here outside of myself and the older gentleman, Reuven and Yitzchak, I don't know if anyone else has been in the IDF. Zev, you've been in the army, right? So there are four of us here, right? Am I correct? There are four of us that have been in the army. I don't know how many of you fought in wars. I know Reuven fought and I fought. The minute you go into a battlefield, or let's say I fought in the as a soldier in 73, I was a volunteer, but as a soldier, the minute you crossed into Lebanon in 82, they write down your name. It's extremely important as each car goes in, as each half track goes in, as each troop carrier goes in, as each tank goes in, as each plane goes in, helicopter, artillery, what have you. They write down exactly who's in each vehicle with your mispari shi. Why did they do that? for very simple reasons. If anything happens and there's a direct hit, and God have mercy, the tank, and I've been involved in this, but the tank is ashes afterwards. There's no way you can identify anyone, anything. You know who is in the tank? So they write down the names. Tell me, are you allowed to write down the names on Shabbat? No. What do you think? Are you allowed? Think for a minute. Right, what's going on? This is not fighting. This is not what we call batash, bitachon, shoteif. This is not, absolutely, it's pikuach nefesh, it's morale. If you don't write down the names, the soldier is going to feel nobody cares about me. Plus, look, we all have to be realists. An army, people die. Look what Roy Klein did. I mean, the bravery of that individual. And yet, a government held up by Shas, the Minister of Education, that woman, I don't want to mention her name, she has cut the budget for, she hates the Kippah Strugah with a passion. We are the enemies of Klal Yisrael, what they used to call in Russia, enemies of the people. That's the way she views us. Right or wrong? Thank you, Rabbi Rubin. Rabbi Rubin validates that Rakefet is telling the truth for once. Baruch Hashem. Baruch, you got a long way to go to understand the Rebbe, but you're going to get there. You're going to pelt it out and you're going to get there. Where's Shimon? I'm working on his name, his last name. Tell him to show up. I want a master in Iranian name. My dear students, ask you another question. You've all learned the Sugya and Shabbos. Somebody dies on Shabbat. Lo aleinu. How do you move the body? The body's in the sun, right? I'm talking about the Gemara. What does the Gemara say? What do you do? What would tell me? What do you do? You put a challah on the body and move it, right? Should be davah hamuksa, davah sheinah muksa, etc. Basasa davah sheinah muksa, whatever. Fine. No, you're on a battlefield. There are bodies. Where are you going to find the challah? What are we going to do? And this really is a stronger example than the first example I gave you, because here, what's the pikuach nefesh? The guy is dead. Now, what do you think it does to the morale of the soldiers that the bodies are left on the battlefield? Halacha l'maisa, the chevra kadisha functions on Shabbos, just like during the week. Bodies will be removed, everything will be cleaned up, a kavod, everything that has to be done, alpi halacha, will be done. The same answer, morale. Now, if you translate what I've just said, you now have another side of the coin. It could be the price we pay for Gilad Shalit is unfair, is criminal. But if we don't pay it, we're leaving a message for Tzva Haganah Yisrael that if your muzzle is as bad as Gilad Shalit, we're going to forget about you. And this demoralizes the young man going in that day that he enters the army, that they take his tooth chart, that they take his fingerprints, that they take a DNA sample. I don't know what it is, a piece of hair I think they take today. If anyone's a doctor, you can. I think that's what they do, but I may be wrong. And it's all computerized. I mean, this is just an amazing world, the way things work today. When the computers are working, it's unbelievable. The problem is that half the time I walk into a bank in Israel, and even in America, the computers are down. All human progress comes to a halt. It's just an amazing thing. The computers are down. But all right, it's an amazing world today. But the problem is real. So therefore, just let me summarize. When I spoke about the Nod B'Yehuda, and I spoke about that Solat Klal Yisrael, and I gave you an example of what's going on today in Israel, you can start to understand the depth of the problem. A lot of people, and I'm one of them too, you know, we take for granted, believe me, I'm not a fan of Olmert. And I'm not a fan of Ehud Barak. Not a fan of a man who deserts the wife of his youth and runs off with his old girlfriend. At least I'll say about Olmert, his wife controls him, but that's a different story. She's a big leftist, and you look at the kids they raised, you can commit hari-kari. Pshuto kamashma'o. I'm not a great fan of theirs. But one thing I want you to know, I hear people, Americans, maledict them. You know, I was just in America. I traveled in so many different areas. They have people maledict them. They're not evil people. They mean well. It's the way they think. They think differently. They're not evil. And this question of what to do for Shalit, this question haunts them. And they are caught with a tremendous quagmire. Because I challenge anyone in this class to come out and give me an answer of pialacha, black and white. Don't redeem him, do redeem him. Pay the 500, endanger the lives of the 40 other Jews, 50 other Jews, statistically. And who knows if it's not us. Dennis, what was his name? The frum guy, Kurtzer, Danny Kurtzer. A big, big dove, a big peacenik, always was. You don't know. And when Menachem Begin, he was dean of Yeshiva College, when Menachem Begin appeared at Yeshiva College, he walked out. The dean walked out in protest. It's not something new. Then suddenly his cousin gets killed in a pigua on a bus in Yerushalayim. I believe it was a Holocaust survivor. And imagine to be blown to smithereens on a bus here. So, you know, it's easy to talk when it's Yenim. But when it's you, who knows who will be killed? And yet, what do you do for the morale of the Israeli army that you're making a statement, klapei chutz, we're going to let him rot. The price is too high. We're not paying it. We're letting him remain on the battlefield. This is the dilemma that we face now. And I don't believe there's a black and white halachic answer. Okay, I want to go one step further. We can discuss it out infinite. Okay, Michael, yeah. What do you want to say? Yeah, not beside them. I'm well aware of it. You're asking the opposite side. But on the other hand, if you're the soldier who's captured, let me tell you something. In basic, if you're the soldier, if you would be Shalit, how would you feel? Let me tell you a little story. Right, not beside us, so you have to be a Roe Klein. Most people are not Roe Klein. Most people, it's out the Etnapshi Vishalom al Yisrael. If we could go into Gaza and pull Shalit out, the last time we tried to pull a prisoner out, Waxman, you know what happened. So, and that was the Sayeret Matkal. That was an elite, one of our most elite groups. They don't know.
We have to ask them that we will, not that we'll go get them out. We will do them so much harm until they release them.
All right. So you're talking logic.
Yes,
and they're waiting. The Hamas is waiting with unabated breath. We should come in and they'll kill us. They have booby traps. Say that. Just be aware. It's not an easy question. Okay. I'll tell you one light point. Let me loosen the tension because it's a terrible, terrible question, and I suffer with it. I have to tell you that I'm inclined to say under no means release the 500. But I always say to myself, how would you feel if it was your son, or if you were the Shalit? It's not so simple, and not everyone is Roe Klein. Roe Klein is a dugma l'dorot, what we raised. And we today are enemies of the state. The Haredim are their best friends. I button my lips. Let me not say another word. It's sickening. Okay, and people don't understand me because anyone listening, hundreds are listening in America and in Australia and South Africa. If you don't live here, you don't understand what's going on. Okay, let me not say another word. But I want to tell you one story, true story. I'm in basic training, all right? 1976, I'm 38 years of age. All right, I live with a policy: when you do something, do it to the best. Man, I don't have to tell you, I'm not ashamed to tell you, I was the Chayil Mitztayein, and I went to awards for sharpshooting. It was really, really, it was hard, but it was a fun time in my life, believe me. So once a week, we have a lecture from Chinuch. And this lecture was on going into battle and in case you get captured. And we're getting instructions. And, you know, you can picture the site. It's a shlav bet. The average age, let's say I was one of the older people. The average age was 33, 34. Plenty of Russians, plenty of rabbanim there, shlav bet. And what do you do if you get captured? So the commander is telling us, the lecturer, the katzin, is telling us one thing. When you get captured, only speak Hebrew. Don't speak English. Don't speak Russian. Only Hebrew. Why? And he said, because the Egyptians, the Syrians, have plenty of people who speak English and speak Russian. There are fewer people who speak Hebrew. So you make believe you don't know English, you don't know Russian, you only know Hebrew. So one Russian raises his hand, and in his broken Hebrew he says, but I don't know how to speak Hebrew properly, fluently. And the commander says, don't worry, till you get captured, you'll know Hebrew perfectly. Okay, I want to go one step further to close out this topic. And here I have to show you something, and I don't know, I'm very quixotic if this really happened. I really think it's not true. But it entered the halachic literature, and our good friend, or your good friend, many of you have studied with him, Rabbi Dr. J. David Bleich. Recognize the name? Natan, were you in YU? No, so you don't recognize. This is one of the stars in YU, in tradition. I don't believe anyone has ever written more in modern times, in English at least, on halachic issues. He's like a walking encyclopedia. Very knowledgeable. His wife, too, with Baruch Hashem. It's a YU couple, the Tiferet, if you understand what I'm saying. Of course, their children went to Lakewood, such. It's the old story. Reuven, I'm one of the few people who raise children who are frimmer than my wife and I. They're frimmer than we are, and they're bigger Zionists than we are. And that is a rare achievement in this world. Baruch Hashem. So in the latest issue of Tradition, number 40, issue, in other words, the annual 40, issue 3, 207, just caught up with me in the United States. Beginning on page 49, there's a survey of recent halachic periodical literature. And the main issue, the main issue he deals with is the $25 million funeral. Now, I heard this story. It appeared in one of the Haredi magazines, Mishpacha. And people were talking about it. I told them it's a fairy tale. I can't believe this really happened. But it seems that that Reb Yitzchok Zilberstein, in the Kol HaTorah periodical, you get all the sources in Tradition, he dealt with it halachically as if it really happened. Now, that doesn't mean it really happened. Once the issue was raised, I told you when I dealt with the Terumat HaDeshen, remember what I told you? Eitan, there's an entire literature, I dealt with this 20 years ago in class, but there's an entire literature, did the cases that the Terumat HaDeshen really talks about, did it really happen? Or stam lahadir Torah lahadira. You understand? Since Reb Moshe's cases, as we see in our Monday class, they really happen. I'm going to show you stuff tomorrow. Blow your mind. Communist Russia. You know, what I'm telling you, you can learn history from Sheraton Shabbat. That really happened. But Menachem Mendel, when we talk about some of the cases in the Terumat HaDeshen, it may be Lahag de Torah Lahadira. So the story is as follows. Michael, you remember the story? You heard the story? The story is unbelievable. That this guy was married before World War II, Jewish guy, Jewish wife, and World War II breaks out, and his wife is killed. Now, he had one son with her. After his wife is killed, And by the way, this happened all the time. A Gentile woman took him in, protected him, said it's her husband, and he remained, lived with her the rest of his life, and he had a son with the Gentile woman. So now he has two children. One is Jewish from the first wife, and one is non-Jewish from the second wife. And the years went by, and many years later, the Jewish son received notification that his father died, and left an estate of $50 million. That's the figure here. $50 million. All right. For me, it's beyond comprehension, but some of you may deal with people who walk around on that level of money. I know some people who are on that level. I know a few people. Yes, I do know a few people. Baruch Hashem. So $50 million. And the Gentile son is going to get 25 mil, and the Jewish son is going to get 25 mil. Okay? He left it to his two sons. Now, the Jewish son became a Baal Teshuva. See, this is why I can't believe the story is true. It's like a Musa written to get people excited. What the, I don't know what Baal Teshuva can achieve. What? Yes, you call it an art scroll. Okay, it's a Bamishpacha story. I've seen these stories. You thought it was real? Yeah, Rav Bleich thought, right, I'm telling you, Rav Bleich says that since the Yitzchak Zubishtein deals with it, he takes it that it's real. I think my take on it is more correct. Truma Tadeshim, but who am I to argue? Let's say it's real. So the Jewish boy became a Baal Teshuva. And he wants his father to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. The Gentile boy says, under no condition, I want my father buried next to my mother. In a Gentile, my mother was Gentile, and I was raised Gentile, and my father has to be buried next to my mother. And my mother saved his life. I mean, this is Hakaras HaTovim. They had a very good second marriage. They lived together many, many generations, many decades. So the Jewish boy offered, I think he offered $3 million that they should bury him Jewish. He's willing to give up 3 out of the 25. No, the brother heard it, that he's willing to offer money. He says, no, the only way you can bury him Jewish, you take nothing, I get all 50 mil. And the Jewish boy went and gave his brother everything and was able to bury his father in a Jewish cemetery. And that is the story. I have to tell you, I may be a shagetz, I may be a nice faf, but if I got the shaila, I would say very simply, buy up the graves around your father, make dalet amot. You know what's required? We bury Jews and Gentiles together, right? Every cemetery in America has a Jewish section, a Protestant section, a Catholic section. There's no such thing as a Jew. It doesn't pay to have a Jewish cemetery only. Some entrepreneur buys up and you parcel it out. So if you can keep it a dalet amot away, you put up a little mechitza. I would have figured out an etzer, Ribbono Shel Olam, with 25. You don't want to keep all 25 mil, keep 5 mil, and give 20 mil to tztaka, to prop it tztaka. In other words, not that it, not to it tztaka, that you, but to prop it tztaka, what you can do with $25 million, Ribbono Shel Olam, it defies imagination. So that's what I would have paskened. But I was never asked. But I want to show you. He goes through the whole halacha. And if there's a chiyuv, you know, to ransom a captive, you have to ransom a corpse. And if it applies in the Maharami Rottenberg, you know. But at the end, I just want to show you one thing. At the end, Rabbi Bleich makes a statement which I have to say. The Makam Gedulato, there you find his mind suddenly goes off on a very different tangent. And he raises the point that in all that was written on this issue, Rabbi Yitzchak Shlugelstein and those who discussed it, but no one raised the question, how are you allowed to redeem a body for $25 million if ain't po dinat ashvu in your tea kedei de mehem? It is remarkable that the question exhorts tonight. It's a word I never knew before, but it means exhaustion, to extort, or even extraordinary expenditure for the purpose of assuring proper burial has not been addressed in the response literature. In the case under discussion, whether or not he was actually obligated to do so, the conduct of the son who was unhesitant in surrendering the inheritance of a fortune in order to accord his father a proper Jewish burial commands approbation and respect. Now, do you realize what he's saying here? That how come no one raised the issue, if you redeem this body or this corpse for 25 million, they'll start taking other corpses. And I say, and he says he's amazed that no one else raised this issue, that Rabbi Yitzchak Zubelstein. And I say to you, believe me, I want to find another body where he left $50 million, 25 to a Goyish son, 25 to a Jewish son. When we'll come up with one other case like this, I'll worry about the Mishnah in Gittin, Ein Podin et Ashvim Yatzar Kedei Demeyam. But he writes and takes it seriously, that he's amazed that no one has raised this issue. It's all discussed. No, that's part of Reb Yitzchak Zuber's thing's discussion. I only cited. He has pages when J. David Bleich writes something, he writes. He doesn't leave out. But what's amazing to me, it's comical. He's worried. Ain't podin et ashvur yatel yedei the mayhem. And I say to you, I don't believe there'll ever be another case like this. If it really was a case, I don't even believe the first case. It's too fantastic. I mean, wow, with the two sons, 25 million. Well, I don't know. I don't get the New York Times here. Who knows? It would have been in the New York Times. That is correct. But anyway, halacha lemaisa, you see that this whole question of Ein Podin et Ashvun, you tell you they the Mehen, it reverberates. And I showed it to you, the fallout, Latzolot Klal Yisrael, with all the quagmire. I don't want to minimize, because my nature is to be, look, that's the halacha, and you can't redeem him. But think about the morality, the morale of Klal Yisrael, of the Israeli army, of the IDF, leaving a soldier on the battlefield. And I have to tell you, I'm very sensitive to this, for reasons that some of you may know, but just very briefly, I can tell you how this came up in my life so many times. When Malka and I worked for the Mossad, you remember my talk on the Shabbat we spent together. So we didn't realize how it would impact upon our children. And all my children, all my daughters have gone into callings that involve helping other people. It's an amazing thing. All three of my daughters, whatever they do professionally, it involves helping other people. All three. One is in special ed and runs a gun harmony. Well, one is a art therapist, very involved in helping the Gush Katif victims, etc., etc. Russians. One daughter is of course a Tohenet, a lawyer, and very involved in helping victims of Arab terror. She has done wonders, and she's a guardian for certain children who have no parents, were killed by Lo Aleinu, the Arabs, and buses blown up. So what we did had a big impact. We didn't realize it. You know, you don't realize you're living a certain life, but you don't realize how your children are watching and listening and looking and observing. So my middle daughter, in the late 80s, read in the newspapers that the three families of the Sultan Yaakov, the boys missing in action from Sultan Yaakov battle, 1982, two of them were Hezda boys, Yehuda Katz, at Tzadik Yisod Olam, KBY, Zach Baumel from the Gush, and the other boy in Zach's tank was Tzvika Feldman, who was not a Hezda boy, but he was second generation. His parents had survived the Holocaust. The Katzes survived the Holocaust. The Baumels, of course, were American people, and these three boys are missing. Now, my daughter heard the six parents were on a hunger strike in front of the Knesset. So my daughter went to the hunger strike, and somehow she struck up a conversation with the Baumels, and she, until today, is the right hand of Yonah Baumel, the father of Zach, which all that he's accomplished and all that he's done. And one of the underlying principles that guided us in all that we have done, and because of my daughter, once we stopped with the Mossad and Russia became a democratic so-called state and the communism fell, so I was more involved in the Sultan Yaakov, and I've remained very involved in that issue until, as a matter of fact, Thursday of this week, I'm having breakfast with Yonah Baumel and my daughter to discuss the latest developments. But one of the underlying principles was we never leave a soldier on the battlefield. What it does to morale if we don't turn over every stone to try to find out what happened. And you see with Ron Arad, what a fiasco it became because certain mistakes were made in the late 80s, right after he fell into captivity, etc., etc. So it's a tremendous issue, and I'm not here to say black and white, but I am here to call your attention to the pros, the cons, the sources, the dilemma, the quagmire. the heartache. And the 25 million, all right, I don't take it as seriously. It certainly is not an earth-shaking question, but it's a fascinating question, even assuming it never happened. But what do you do, Al Pi Halacha? What are the requirements? Well, one thing I can tell you, into any response that a Gadol Yisrael gives, the issue of Ein Poldin at the Shum Yotel Kedei Demeim, I don't think applies here, because I don't exactly believe there's going to be another case like this. I don't think this case happened. Certainly, I don't believe there'll be another case. Okay. My dear students, we're now moving. Me'inyan li'inyan la'otoinyan. And we're coming to what arguably may be the most famous rabbinic words ever written on the torture of the Holocaust. What I'm about to quote to you and get involved with, we're going to start it today, we're not going to finish it. It has been quoted and requoted, cited and recited. You know, sometimes something is written that just captures all that has to be said. And this source recording? Okay. The source is Mekadshei Hashem. The author is, he is the survivor, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Meislisch. Anyone here from Chicago? He was the head of the Sherit Pleita congregation in Chicago. He is a Mechutin. He was a Mechutin. He's not alive many years. I believe his son is the Rav today. He was a Mechutin to the Satmar Rebbe. Their children married. And when the Satmar Rebbe used to come to Chicago, he would always stay with the Tzvi Hirsch Meislisch, his Mechutin. Rav Tzvi Hirsch went through the horrors of the Holocaust. He was an eyewitness, survived by miracles. I'm quoting from Mekadshei Hashem, Chelek Aleph, what I would call in popular English the introduction. He calls it Sham Machmadim, where he's telling certain stories of unbelievable people who and what they did in these terrible moments. Now, remember we spoke about the Cantonists. And this question of the Cantonists literally happened before his eyes. And he tells the following story. And it's just a replay of the Cantonist story, except unbelievably, God have mercy, what you see. If you want to describe the lowest points of the Holocaust, this is it. The tragedy upon tragedies. And he says, Erev Rosh Hashanah, I don't see an exact year here. Let me see. No, I don't see an exact year. But it could be it's 1943, let's say, 1944 at the latest, but I would imagine 44 perhaps. And Erev Rosh Hashanah, all the youth, 18 years or younger, were gathered together. Everyone was gathered together. The Nazis had given an order. The kapos had to bring every Jewish kid, 18 or younger. One of the concentration camps. He calls it a selectia. He doesn't say. I don't want to start guessing because I don't see an exact identification. And all these kids were lined up. There was a total. He gives the number. 1 second. ,600 young men, 18 and younger. And these were young men who somehow survived and hid out, and now they were all gathered together. It's Auschwitz. Here he mentions that his son was saved, Zalman Leib, and he was 14 at the time, and he was with me in Auschwitz. So he tells you where it was right here. And the head of the camp came and set up a cross, right? And everyone had to walk underneath the cross. If you were not taller than the cross, you were taken aside. And everyone knew what that meant. If you were not taller than the cross, it meant you would be gassed. And he describes that children stood up on their toes, and when the person doing the selection saw that, if he caught a kid standing on his toes, he whacked him and killed him right on the spot. And no matter what they tried to do, anyone who was not really taller than the cross was pulled aside. And once they had this test over, 1,400 Jewish children were found to be shorter than the wood that was like a cross. Took these 1,400 kids, gave them to the capos, and they told the capos, these kids will be gassed tomorrow. They're no longer going to get food and water. And if one kid is missing, you will be executed in their place. So could you imagine? They're going to execute 1,400 kids on first day of Rosh Hashanah. And you see, these were the worst days, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. And it was on purpose. This wasn't by chance, because they knew that these were the holiest days and the days of such emotion and depth. And this is what they were doing. I can tell you in brackets that when we sent people to Russia and the KGB decided to throw them out, inevitably, they kicked them out on Shabbos. Inevitably, you should be aware. And it wasn't by chance. It was done purposely. They were kicked out on Shabbos. And we, you know, we had to give them a psak before they went in. So he asked the Rav, and the Rav, who was paranoid when it came to communism, because if you saw the documentary on the Rav, you saw in his youth what he saw with communism, how they changed Kaslovich around in minutes from a city that was filled with Flim Jews to a city where Flim Jews weren't even allowed to go to shul on Yom Kippur. Other Jews would snitch on them. And the Rav said right away, if they want to throw someone out, at that moment Shabbos ends for him. He forgets about Shabbos until he's in Helsinki. Then he starts observing again. Pikuach nefesh, get going. Don't fight. Don't argue. Don't carry on. You can't carry on Shabbos. The Rav was chad mashmai. But, you know, we told them, some wise guys that were thrown out, said to the KGB, we can't carry, it's our son. They refused to carry, so the agents carried their suitcases to the plane. You got wise guys that have guts, and, you know, they figured I have an American passport. What's the worst? They can smack me around. Rabbi Rubin, who was one of my best shlichim, says if the wise guys wouldn't have been wise guys, they wouldn't have been thrown out. There is truth to what you're saying, that I noticed the people thrown out, generally speaking, it was people with a little bit chutzpah. And the KGB had a way of smelling the chutzpah, and once in a while they decided to ruffle the feathers. It's not so simple, because when they threw out, they antagonized the American State Department. That's why they had to let you come in and do what you had to do, because if they threw too many out, the State Department retaliated and threw out Russians in America. And they were really spies, even if they were industrial spies, bringing back a Sears Roebuck catalog. So that's the answer. But anyway, be it as it may, they threw people out, closed the brackets. They threw people out on Shabbos. It was done purposely. So here it is, Erev Rosh Hashanah.
You know that Michael was in Russia?
Yeah, sure, from Philadelphia. You were Philadelphia. We had more tension on us because we were there with false identity. So it was a little bit more tense, and the operation was more serious in that respect. But you are American-Americans, so I once had a student of mine and his first cousin, and I get a call from the boss 1 o'clock in the morning, And in those days, I still answered the phone in the middle of the night. And the boss told me, you're to reach their wives. They're going to be thrown out. It's going to be on the front page of the New York Times tomorrow. And tell their wives that if anyone calls them from any newspaper and wants to know about their husbands, they're to deny these are their husbands. Their husbands are fine. Their husbands are asleep. And I want to tell you, the next day, front page of the New York Times, two American businessmen expelled from Russia. Now, these guys were businessmen like I'm a Chinaman eating noodles on the moon at this moment in time. One of them ran Gris Kollel, and the other one was a Rebbe in Pardes. And Baruch Hashem, no reporter traced it. And the New York Times had their names and where they live in America. And every boy was eye sweating. Thank God, no one traced it down to Eretz Yisrael at that moment in time. But Baruch Hashem, people have Mesirat Nefesh, but here you're talking they're going to be executed the next day. Now, there were Jews whose children were in there. There were Jews whose only child was in there. They started pleading with the capos. And he goes into a whole analysis here. Again, it's not black and white. And he says some of the capos were bad people to begin with. And that's generally the impression we get from the memoir literature. Some of them, Nebuch, were trying to save their lives. They were not bad people. But they said very simply, if we release your son, they're going to kill us. They're going to take us. How can we release your son if our lives will be forfeit? And I don't have to tell you, Adam Korei Veitzalat Smo. Me, who says, the Damech Sumak Tvei, what makes your son's blood redder than my blood? Right or wrong? Imagine if you're a capo and you want to release the kids, but you know if you're missing one kid from your block, you're finished. No? So then some of the fathers, Lo Aleinu, you remember the Shelet and Shivet we dealt with in the last years, people had gold sewn into their teeth. People had diamonds sewn into their socks. So they took, they collected. So they came to a capo with jewelry, with money. Ah. And this is amazing, human nature, that even in Auschwitz, you see jewelry, you see money. You think you're going to survive. See, that's what I told you. That's that defense mechanism. Many people committed suicide in the Holocaust because they knew they're not going to survive. They gave up the battle for life. But when you have that feeling, that defense mechanism, I'm going to survive. I'm going to make it. Oh, you look at the jewelry. You look at the money. Ah, the capo is interested. But now it's like the Cantonists, because the capo is not that stupid, that for jewelry and money, he forfeits his life. Ryan, the whole reason he wants the jewelry and money is to have with what to live afterwards. If he lets go of your son, he will capture another Jewish boy who passed the test. He will grab him, and he will throw him into the cloistered area to die on the next day. And could you imagine what we're talking about? What he sees, what's happening, and he says, people, some people just have limited intelligence. I don't know if the word is limited intelligence, but I think he uses the word limited intelligence. That's the word he used. Kotzer hasaga shelo asu sum cheshbonot. I don't know if it's kotzer hasaga. I think under the pressures of the moment, you just want to save your own. You don't care about anyone else. And these people just didn't think, didn't care. They wanted to redeem their sons at all cost. Nothing else mattered to them. And then he tells the famous story that I can't believe you haven't heard the story. This is the source. And this is a true story. This is not now $50 million, $25 million floating around. Replenish Shalom. Bring me that case, halacha lemaisa, and I'll figure out how to keep the 25 mil. And we'll come out. A guy lived with a guy for 50 years. I have to start worrying about his burial now. See what a bad Jew I am? I hear a chance to grab 25 mil and do something for charity. I'm just thinking in my mind, what would I do with it? I know what I would do with it. I would do something in Shvitami for Russian Jewry. That would be fabulous. Okay, I know what I'm going to do with it. All right, let's see. Do me a favor, Michael. Check out the case. Let me know if I got a chance, if it's real or not. Anyway, here it's real. And he tells the following story. A simple-looking Jew, I love, from a Hungarian Oibolan, a simple-looking Jew. Yeah, you know what? You got to understand what that means. A simple-looking Jew. I met him in Borough Park years ago. It was one of the rabbanim there. So he was American-born or Canadian-born, but his English was native. But you know, a Borough Park rav. And he had read all my articles in Jewish life in the 60s. And you don't know what Jewish life was. Jewish life was the first publication in America, an Orthodox quarterly, I think it was. If I'm not mistaken, it was a quarterly. And it came out, published by the Orthodox Union. And I have the privilege, I published more articles in Jewish life than any other author. And he read all my articles on Gedolei Yisrael, and I wrote about life in Israel in the 60s into the 70s. And he read all my articles, and then he met me. I went over to him. I happened to be in Borough Park, and it turned out my mother's second husband worked with him. He had been head of the Shmirat Shabbat. He was the Rav. My stepfather was the layperson who pleaded with the stores on 13th Avenue to close on Shabbat. Baruch can't believe what I'm saying. They take them to all the Baal Tshuva. They take the 13th Avenue to show them Yerushalayim in Borough Park. They plead them to close them. So he looks at me and he says, "Oh, you're a Moderna. You're a modern person. You know, shave, clean shaven, no rabbinic dress, a simple looking Jew." That's the way he describes this Jew who came over to him. Yehudi Pashut, B'tmimut. And he came over to me and he gives a description of one full page recording their conversation in Yiddish word by word. He comes up and says, "Rebbe, I have a shaila for you. I have a lot of money that I had hidden. My only son is designated to die. I want to redeem him. Am I allowed to redeem him? Because I know if I do redeem him, the couples will take another Jewish boy in his place. Am I allowed?" Nu, what a shaila. That, Eitan, is a shaila. This is not now 25 million in the grave. This is, are you allowed? The father has the money. And the couple he's dealing with is interested. And he'll give him his kid back. Again, you know, it's Chayei Shah. Ultimately, they all die. But it's Chayei Shah, okay? And he's going to give him, and again, the will to live. Mashiach will come tomorrow. I'll talk about this on Monday morning when I deal with the Holocaust from a theological point of view, a philosophic point of view. But the will to live. I can redeem him. I can have my son, my only son. What's more precious than an only son? Can I redeem him? And he wants an answer. And Rav Meishlis pleads with him. I don't have Svarim here. There are no other Rabbanim here. Have nobody to consult with. And he says, "Rebbe, I want an answer." And Rav Meishlis starts thinking. He says, "Maybe if it would be as follows, that the kapo would give you the son, and then he would first look for another victim, maybe the kapo wouldn't look for another victim. Why should he kill another Jewish boy? Maybe they won't make an accurate count. Maybe you can say they made a mistake. Maybe he can bluff his way out of it. So then maybe it would be permitted." But then Rav Meishlis says, But I know that the way they work, they're not going to let the boy out. They first make a deal. They agree to the deal. Then they say, hold on to your money. We have to find another victim. No one wants to endanger his life with the Nazis. And therefore, once they find the other victim, they take the money, release your son. But look what you're doing. You are placing your son, taking him out, redeeming him, and because of that, another boy is going to be killed. And you have here the exact case of the Cantonist, the only difference being that with the Cantonist, it wasn't physical death, mainly it was spiritual death, because they took them for 25 years. So you took a kid of 12 or 13, and you take him to an alien environment, what will he be like 25 years later? There are a few that remain from Chabad literature, is filled with some fabulous stories of Cantonists who went in at the age of 13 and 14 and remained slim despite all the vicissitudes. But what a case, what a question. And he wants an answer. And the Zvi Hirschmeissel, and he records the conversation, he says, Ich kenne sie nicht, ich hätte nicht an diese, ich weiß nicht, ich habe nicht kein Schwamm, ich habe nicht kein Rabban mit mir, ich kann durchretten. He says, tut wie ihr versteht. Translation. I can't say a Heter. I can't say a Nisa. I don't have Sperm. I have no one to talk with. There are no other Rabbanim here. Do as you understand. And the father says, Rebbe, I came to ask a Shaila. You have to give me an answer. And he says, I don't have a black and white answer. And then the father says, Rebbe, I see that you're hesitant to tell me it's permissible. This indicates to me it's forbidden. And Reb Zvi Hirschmeissel describes the father on Rosh Hashanah while the gas chambers are working, while the crematorium is working, how the father went around Ashreini Shazachini Lahakrivet Bini Yechidi Ka'avram Avinu. I have sacrifice my son, I'm on a higher level than Avram Avinu, because God told them, Al tishlach yobchel hana, but in my case, nothing saved my son, and he was sacrificed on this Rosh Hashanah. And this is an unbelievable story, an unbelievable case, an unbelievable question, and this actually happened in Auschwitz. This is one example, halakha l'maisa, where the Cantonist question comes and stares us in the face, and Reb Zvi Hirschmeissel refused to paskin. It's one story. Okay? Now there's a second story. A second story, also very famous, Shem Yirachem. We have the name of the person, Moshe Rosenberg, Hashem Yikom Damo. He was in Auschwitz. He was 20 years of age, or close to 20, but he had one chisaron, one shortcoming, very short. Somehow everyone in this classroom is not very short. But I've had students, I remember I had a student, the Kollel, I can remember my words to him. He must have been 5'6". And he had such trouble going out because most girls don't want to go out with someone 5'6". I remember saying to him, a short young man has to marry, you can't give up. Baruch Hashem. Later met a girl who was maybe 5'3 herself, and Hazivik Allah Yafeh. But this person was very short. And because he was so short, he couldn't get away, even though he was above 18, he was close to 20. He failed the test, and he too is with the young people ready to be killed. And this Moshe Rosenberg from Hungary, this has to be 44, because he's describing they're all from Hungary. So this all going to happen in 44, if my knowledge of the Holocaust is correct. I'm not an expert, but I would say it's 44. It can't be 45, and 43 would be too early. So this Moshe Rosenberg is a gone, is a must-mid. He learns day and night, muflak b'Torah. And when he learned in the yeshiva in Witzen, there was a big yeshiva, he would learn with the younger kids, and he would be the Chazarabacha. That was the person who went over the Rebbe Shir. That was like Rabbi Lichtenstein. When I came into the Rebbe Shir, when the Rebbe started his college Shir in 57, so Rabbi was the Chazarabacha. His job was to say over the Shayur, see that we understood it. He was the Chazarabacha. So this is what this young man was, this Moshe Rosenberg, outstanding, capable, and he is condemned to death. Along comes one of the young Talmidim, and he gives the name Akiva Mann, if I'm pronouncing it right, Mem Aleph Nun Nun Sofi, Man, Man, or Manan, Akiva Man, let's say, Hashem Yikom Damo, a younger student, 15 years old, from the Witzen Yeshiva, and he comes over, he's tall, and he was saved, and he comes over to Reb Tzvi Hirsch Meislich, and he's hysterical. He says to Reb Tzvi Hirsch, is it possible that they're going to destroy, to burn Meishela? And we're going to be quiet? And I say, and Reb Tzvi says, and I said to this kid, Nu, do you have a solution? Do you have an etzah? Do you have advice? How can we save him? And he says, King, yes, I have advice. And he says, I have a lot of money that I've put together, that I've saved. I want to give it to him. We will redeem him. So Reb Tzvi says, what's the good of redeeming him? Don't you understand that if you redeem him, they're going to take another kid and kill the other kid? And how do we have a right to pull this one out who's already been captured and allow them to take another kid in his place? The same Shaila. Can't do it. So this youngster says, Akiva says, I have a different etzah. Let's redeem him, and I'll go in his place. And he says, who am I? What am I? I'm a batlan. I didn't learn, you see, his self-image. I don't have Yirat Shemayim. I'm not a lamdan. I'm not a matmid. I willingly will give my life for Meshela, who's a tzaddik and a lamdan and a matnid and Yirei Shemayim, mekabel alay b'simcha rabba, liyot kaban to mirato. And I'm mekabel b'pe malay that I should be a korban to mura, an exchange sacrifice for Moshe. And I told him, what are you talking about? This is not so. This can't be. Forget it. Don't do it. Don't think it. You have to live. You're not in there. You're taller. This is something in a Shemayim. And I rebuked him, and he came back to me again, and he said, Rebbe, I cannot find Menuchat HaNefesh. I cannot rest. And I insist, let me be the korban tumura for Meshela. And finally, I yelled at him. I shouted at him. I told him I can't agree with him. And I pushed him away. He had no choice. He had to listen to me. But he says, unfortunately, later on, he was killed as well. So not only Moshe, but Akiva as well. Hashem Yikom Damam. Now, in this description, which is factual, he raises a halachic issue. A halachic issue that haunts us and is part of life until this very second and for the foreseeable future. What am I talking about? Let me describe to you. I'm walking in Shari Chesed. Do you know Shari Chesed? You know what I'm talking about, Baruch? It's next to Rechavia. It's a frum area next to Rechavia. A lot of Anglos there, a lot of French. That's right, Reb Shmuel Orbach, quite a few yeshiva there. And I see two yeshiva boys smoking. Nothing gets me more angry than to see yeshiva boys, black hats as you call them, smoking. So I should mind my own business, but I can't. So I go over to them, nice boys, American kids. I say, you guys are murderers. You're not just killing yourself. You're killing me. They look at me. I say, where'd you go to high school? You know, typical American yeshiva went to some high school where they never opened a secular book and yet got a high school degree. Never went to college, chas v'chalila. And I tell, let me teach you a French word, triage. Do you know what that word means? No. I said, no hospital. There's not enough money in any country to pay for all the illness and all the medicine and all the sickness and all the equipment that we need. So triage is a French word. It means you have to choose. And it's part of every hospital situation, every emergency situation, who shall live and who shall die. And because you're smoking, you're going to be sick, you're going to have lung cancer, and the ultimate end is that you require medical treatment and medical money, medical sources, what word did you use?
Equipment.
Medical equipment, medical medicine, attention. And you're taking money away from the general populace. You're killing yourselves and you're killing me. Ah, right away, you know, well, we didn't think, no, but it is, blah, blah. I told them, why don't you come to my shir and we'll do some, try to help you in Gress. So they took down the name, the number. I saw them again like a Chinaman is dancing on the moon. But triage is a real problem. And let me raise the issue. Can we choose one over another? Can we be involved with triage? How does a hospital work? For the sake of argument, David Applebaum's famous lecture, if an Israeli soldier is lightly wounded and a terrorist is badly wounded, whom do you treat first? According to medical ethics, you have to treat the badly wounded person first. That triage begins right on the battlefield. If you can save him. Then you have triage in every hospital. Well, this guy is 85 and this woman is 55. It's the same illness. We can only give attention to one of them. They're going to choose the 55-year-old, unless it's the President of the United States or some famous individual like Mickey Mantle, if you recall. They wasted a liver transplant on him. But they claim that it did good because as a result of his death, they got more donations than ever. They were able to harvest more organs than ever. But this is triage. This goes on all the time. My dear students, do we find triage in the Mishnah? In the Torah Sheba'al Peh? Absolutely. And let me end off the class. And this is the source that Rav Meishlis brings in. And I'll show you next week how he brings it in and what he concludes. And I'll show you the firestorm he creates. Very fascinating. Horiyot, Perikimel, Mishnah Zion. Whoa, how are we getting music? What's happening out? Can you close the door? It's closed. No. Oh, okay. Maybe they have Misha Nichnas Adar. I don't know. To me, it's Adar Sheni that Misha Nichnas. But okay, there's a Purim Katan. It doesn't matter. Kolam Aber Hareza Meshubach. Mishnah Zayin. Ha'ish Kol Dem Le'isha להחיות ולהשיבה וידה. והאישה קודמת לאיש לחסות ולהוציאה מבית השבי. There you have a classic example of triage. That's of course the Rebbe, Rabbam, who comes with the father. But one second, this is the Mishnah. That's a sugya bat metzia. But this is black and white. That if you can save one person, you can't save two. The man comes before the woman, and all the Rishonim explain because the man has more mitzvah than a woman. I'm not saying halacha l'maisa. I'll show you afterwards. But this is the Mishnah. La shiva veda. What is? Why is a man before a woman? Because a man is involved in business. This is money. This is an aveda. He's the one who's out in the world. So when it comes to monetary matters, the man comes first. When it comes to ksut, they don't have money for clothes. We have to clothe the woman before the man. Because for a woman, it's a greater busha to walk around unclothed, to walk around naked. For a man, it's very limited what you have to clothe. But a woman, much more of the body has to be clothed, and she comes first. When they're captured, it is the woman you have to take out first, not the man. The reason is simple, that when a woman is captured, you're worried they will take advantage of her sexually. You have to redeem her first. And then there's something else in this Mishnah, which many of the contemporary people, including the New York Times, would find abhorrent, terrible. Many of our liberal Jews, what does the rest of the Mishnah say? Bizman sheshneihem omdim lekalkala, ha'ish koldim le'isha. That if they both face sexual abuse, then we redeem the man before the woman. Why? And all the Rishonim learn exactly the same pshat, because if a man is going to be used for sodomy, for homosexuality, for mishkevei zacha, this is abominable. It's terrible. A woman who is lo aleinu seduced or raped, use whatever term you want, but at least that's a normal action. It's not something as abhorrent as a masculine sex. And that's the Mishnah. And from here you see that homosexuality is just, it defies imagination that we have to speak and explain why homosexuality is a abhorrent act. Put it that way. It defies the imagination that this is where we're at in the year 2008. May I quote BBC to you? In the year 2000, BBC interviewed a number of people in London who were over 100 years of age and in perfect mind. And one of the people they interviewed, they asked him, what is the most shocking thing that's happened these last 100 years? And this man answered, I never dreamt that the human race will become so decadent that they talk in terms of two males marrying and two females marrying. And I tell you, I don't know who the guy was, but it was a pleasure to hear a human being speak like a human being. Okay, but that's the pshat. That's the pshat. Mishum, omdim lekalkala. So right away, you see there's triage. You see, triage is part of life. Unfortunately, you constantly have to make decisions. And then you have the next Mishnah, the very famous Mishnah, Mishnah Chet, Kohen Koldim Levi. Levi Yisrael. Right there I've said something which halachically has to be questioned. We'll deal with it next week. Yisrael Mamsa, Mamsa Natin, Natin Leger, Ger Liyavet Mishukhra, Eimatai, Bizman Shekulin Shavin. Avalim Chayam Mamza Talmud Chacham. V'kohen godel amoretz, mamza talmud chacham, kodem l'kohen godel am haaretz. What a Mishnah. That is a Litvisha Mishnah. That is in consonance with the shiur I gave 2 weeks ago on Birchat HaTorah. But what do you see from that Mishnah? The concept of triage is constantly with us. It's part of the human race. It's part of the human dilemma. It's part of the human reality. We can't escape triage. It haunts us throughout life. In a simple example, you go to the airport. You are okayed for an El Al flight. All of you know El Al overbooks by 20% on every flight. They do not put you on standby until they hit 120%. Why do they overbook? They overbook because statistics have taught them that 25% to 30% of the people who are okayed for the flight do not show. And when an airline takes off and there's an empty seat, it is a loss. It's not like a can of tuna fish that if you don't buy it today, you'll buy it tomorrow. El Al taking off is like a bottle of milk that only has limited life. The plane is gone, the seat is empty. So they'd rather overbook, and let's say one time out of 10 it happens that too many people show up, so they pay a fine, they pay this. It works out much cheaper for them. Ah, but now 12 additional people have shown up for the plane. Who do you choose? Who goes on? Triage. Right there. El Al. Every airline. Every Monday and Thursday. Right there. You have the problem. How do you choose? Who do you select? This one says, I got to be at a meeting. This one says, I'm sitting shiver. This one says, I have to make a wedding. Everyone has a different reason why they must be on the flight. Who do you choose? Michael, it's with us.
Be a volunteer. And I made it on Delta Airlines to Brussels. And there was nothing leaving Brussels except an El Al flight. And there were literally hundreds of people.
Right.
Waiting. And these Israeli agents had to decide who to go on.
Right. Triage. Soldiers. Right.
And then the next group were basically people who they felt could make a contribution. So there were all these Hasidim. And it was me. And they said, what are you in Israel for? And I said, I'm going to go to be a volunteer, and I don't care where I go. I want to volunteer somewhere. And they put me on the flight over Israelis.
Triage. 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 I hope you heard the story on the tape. Okay, triage. Gentlemen, you have proven my point. Even with an El Al flight, Allah come to the hospital. Anyway, it's an amazing Mishnah. And you'll see what happens with that Mishnah. Okay, but let me reiterate. One second. Yitzchak, let me just reiterate. So what have we done today? We finished up Dr. Esther Farbstein. We went in to the Israeli army and morale. We dealt with the $25 million, $50 million corpse. Ein podin et shvun yatal demehem. Then we're moving along, the Cantonist question, and the unbelievable question of Akiva, who wants to give his life for Moshe. Are you allowed? And do we have a concept of triage? And that was the Mishnah I quoted to you, and I want to show you what Rav Tzvi Ishmael does with the Mishnah, and what the response is. There's Rav Hashem next week. Tomorrow, I continue with Rav Moshe. We're going to hit something at the start of the class that is one of a kind. I don't believe it has ever been asked before and has ever been asked afterwards. And you'll see communism before your eyes. I want to mention, if you recall in class, I challenged Rabbi David Cohn of Brooklyn on his cutting off the Rav back in 1959. And I sent him the material from the Briscoe's books, and I got an answer today. The answer is, it doesn't say much, but at least he acknowledges what I sent him, and that's the Briscoe Rav Zatzal B'Kavod, David Cohen with the date. So I finally concluded why the Rav was upsetting to him, and reading it in the book is not. And the answer is very simple. When the Rav spoke, he spoke with passion. When you hear him speak with passion, yeah, the Briscoe Rav didn't see Ben Gurion, and the Chazon Ish did, it's like a criticism. When you read it, you're glancing at it. It doesn't hit you as hard. So I'm a Lamed Zchud and Rav David Cohen, although the answer to me is not exactly Lanyan, but I'm a Lamed Zchud that he heard the Rav and it troubled him and bothered him. And that's why he responded that way, although so many years later, the Haredi world is saying exactly the same thing. If anyone wants a copy of the picture of the Rav, I made more copies of both pictures. Just
also this book.
This book is yours, but it's missing volume one. I don't know where to get it. Anyone want the latest Nakuda? A very good issue. Pass that back. And pass this back to that gentleman. Okay? That's for you. Take that. That's for David. What I want David to do, 6 tapes are in there, right? Take a look. Okay? What I want David to do is create an MP3 out of it and tell him everyone bothers me for that topic. It'll be very important for me to give out. Okay? It's 9 hours. So it can't go on to 2 CDs. It has to go on to an MP3, I think. Okay. If you bring it back, fine. Yeah, I know you're coming for Purim. But talk with David and see what he can do. Okay? Two shekels. That's the Rav dancing with a collar at a wedding many years ago. Can you believe the picture? The Chatan just died, and in his they went through his possessions, and they found this picture. And the other picture has the Rav and Reb Chaim Heller.